From there on, things rapidly began to snowball. William had already abstracted several chops and other cuts of meat from the deep-freeze, and these were defrosting in his room. He had enough potential corpses, he said, to keep Daisy going for days if necessary. "Though the sooner Aunt Lucy clears off, the better," he added. "I'd give anything for a lamb chop with mint sauce." They all would. Meals, on Mr. Bagthorpe's instructions, were becoming increasingly Spartan. He, too, it appeared, wished his elderly relative elsewhere. Daisy invited Great-Aunt Lucy to the funeral, but she had strenuously declined. "She said I mustn't mention poor dead things," Daisy told the rest indignantly, as they assembled for the funeral of the chop. "Silly old Griffin."
Griffin.
Daisy was, as had been anticipated, somewhat disappointed at the lack of resemblance of the chop to a real dead lamb, but soon perked up when she saw the increased number of mourners, and was informed that a bell would toll. "And I'll take some photos," Rosie promised. William had selected a suitable spot for the interment, in full view of Great-Aunt Lucy's window. She had gone up to her room for a doze, because, she had informed them all at lunch, the full moon was now imminent. Mrs. Fosdyke had a prolonged fit of choking when she heard this. "I shall require some heavier curtains, Laura," Great-Aunt Lucy had continued. "The ones hanging at present are quite inadequate. The rays of the moon will pass straight through them. I am already beginning to be affected by them." Mrs. Bagthorpe had looked quite desperate at this, and Jack longed to tell her that her fears were groundless, because the old lady would almost certainly have left before the full moon. Aunt Lucy was wakened, as had been intended, by the loud tolling of William's bell, and Jack, glancing up, saw her inadequate curtains move, and caught a glimpse of her face. The funeral went swimmingly. Daisy, once she had accepted the fact that her corpse was dismembered, acted as bereaved as she ever had. A further funeral took place several hours later, and she wept at that, too. "Poor dead piglet! Poor dead piglet!" she sobbed, as the pork chop was laid in its shallow grave. "Dusters to dusters, ashes to ashes!" The younger Bagthorpes themselves found that they, too, were enjoying the proceedings, though they sometimes had difficulty in disguising their giggles as sobs, and Tess was in fact reproved for this on one occasion. "You never laugh at funerals," Daisy told her severely. "You cry. Just try to think of the poor dead lamb. How would you like to be a poor dead lamb?" A relentless procession of chops, then, made their way to the grave, and a curious assortment of headstones sprang up in the part of the garden designated as the graveyard. Daisy was running out of things large enough for her to write her epitaphs on, so had now adopted the policy of selecting articles for their ornamental value, and then attaching her poems on sheets of paper, either taped or pinned on. There was a cross formed by a ruler and silver spoon taped together, a brass candlestick, a pair of cast-iron Punch-and-Judy doorstops, and a large Staffordshire figure which, Daisy said, reminded her of an angel. She was increasingly exercised in the composition of suitable epitaphs, because all her corpses at present fell into only two categories. "I'm getting bored writing poems just about lambs and piglets," she said, as she attached her latest composition to Mr. Bagthorpe's shooting stick. "I wish I could bury something different, forever and ever, amen." The epitaph read, "All the lambs are dying, all the lambs are dead. Everyone is crying, 'cause the lambs has gone to bed. Forever and ever. 1629-1650. This seemed to Jack to have a more than usually final ring to it. Daisy's boredom threshold was known to be notoriously low. He intensified his search for something more out of the way for her to work on. In the meantime, William told her that one of the chops was a cow, and another a giraffe, it being unlikely that Daisy would see through this fraud. The other prong of that campaign to drive Great-Aunt Lucy away was also going extremely well. When the younger Bagthorpes were hatching up their scheme to steer conversation whenever possible to the subject of time, they were not aware that Grandma had privately decided on exactly the same line of action herself. She had, without even extending it, a considerable repertoire of gloomy quotes that she would come up with when she was feeling low. Like as the waves make towards the pebbled shore, so do our minutes hasten to their end, was one of her favorites, and she was also fond of telling everybody, Time, like an ever-rolling stream, bears all its sons away. Mealtimes, then, became extremely morbid occasions, what with the insipidity of the menus, most people wearing black because of the imminence of yet another funeral, and the lugubrious nature of the conversation. When even Rosie started coming out with things like, Ever at my heels I hear Time's winged chariot hurrying near, and Gather ye rosebuds while ye may, old Time is still a-flying, with particular emphasis on the word time, Mr. Bagthorpe cottoned on to what was happening. He did nothing to prevent it, however, and even stopped his wife from doing so. It'll do 'em good, ferreting round for all those quotations, he told her. They have read more Shakespeare in the last 2 days than in the rest of their lives put together. They are rounding off their education. It is an ill wind, Laura. Try to look at it like that. I do think it is all rather unfair on the poor old lady, she told him. Bilge, returned Mr. Bagthorpe. Poor nothing. If she's got a bee in her bonnet about time, it's our duty to smoke it out, not pander to it. When Mrs. Bagthorpe pointed out that a reluctance to accept the idea of mortality was not strictly a bee in the bonnet, but a fairly common human frailty, he replied that he did not agree. No life could be properly lived except in the full consciousness of eventual death, he said, and furthermore, some people even welcomed the prospect, as he did himself at times. And if eating kippers at all the hours God sends is not a bee in the bonnet, you tell me what is, he said. William had better get on to that anonymous fellow from Grimsby and get him to catch further supplies. The North Sea will soon be bled dry of kippers. But she may genuinely believe there is no such thing as time, Mrs. Bagthorpe persisted. I really think she does. I think we should give her the benefit of the doubt. Mr. Bagthorpe was not in the habit of giving anyone the benefit of the doubt, and he was not about to start now. If she genuinely does not believe in time, he replied, then the only logical thing for her to do is to clear off to where there isn't any, namely, eternity. Great Aunt Lucy was, in fact, about to clear off. She shuffled, however, not off the mortal coil, but off out of the Bagthorpe household and into the hospital. This calamity was brought about entirely by herself, and nobody, Mrs. Bagthorpe said, was likely to be cut out of her will on account of it. If, indeed, any of us still figure in it, she added worriedly. I do think you have all tormented that old lady dreadfully. Rubbish, Laura, Grandma told her with asperity. She enjoyed every moment of her stay. She aggravated every one of us, and enjoyed doing so. I could tell. She probably could. When it came to aggravating people, Grandma could teach most people a few things, and certainly Great Aunt Lucy, who was not even in the same league.